Good morning. 5 years ago, the leadership group invited me to take on the responsibility of project coordinator for our building project. The idea was to have one person who was to know everything about what was happening and keep the project on time and on budget by facilitating communications between all persons and committees involved in the project. For some reason, they thought I was up to the challenge. Later, I learned that my dear husband had given his blessing by telling them that I had recently retired from 10,000 villages and needed something to do. He also thought I would be up for it. I had already been involved in the process for more than 5 years as we discerned who we were and who we wanted to be. We had explored splitting into two churches, having two worship services on Sunday morning, trading buildings with another church. But in the end, both we and Walnut Hill just plain needed more space for our children. When nothing else seemed right, we decided to move ahead and plan and expand on this site. As a person who had been on the assembly task forces during this process, and with my close connections with Walnut Hill, I guess leadership thought that I would be a good person to carry on. I agreed to do with the understanding that Dana would be hired as the general contractor. It has been an eventful 5 years. We hired the architectural firm of Architect Design Group from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and started working on plans. We talked about classrooms, expanded worship space, more offices, playground, memorial garden, landscaping, and we began exploring ways to raise money. Then, Walnut Hill served a curveball and decided to strike out on their own. So it was back to the drawing board. Discarding many of our plans and working on new plans and a new approach to fundraising. Through all the changes, our architects stuck with us. They are here this morning. They have stood once, but I'm going to ask them to stand again. Robert Overheiser, who was the lead architect from Architect Design Group, and Anita Taves, who came out of retirement to work with us. And hopefully we'll hear from Anita a little bit later. Thank you both very much. We are very grateful for your good leadership in helping us create this building. With all the planning and the permits and the local and state regulations to be navigated, it wasn't until January of 2018 that we were ready to begin the actual work. We started by renovating the old part of the building first. Again, many of you helped with that. Kudos to Dana and to the office staff who planned the process so that we could continue worshiping and having Sunday school in our building throughout this whole process. Finally, last spring, over a year ago, we were ready to start on this new part of the building. A lot of hard work has gone into these last 16 months. A group of dedicated people we called the Construction Committee. That's John Blosser, Ann Graber Miller, Sybil Gehrig, Alan Greaser, Laura Knopfsinger, Brian Mast, and Dana and I met almost every week to talk over what decisions needed to be made next and who was going to follow through on them. This group took very seriously your trust in us to have a building that reflects our Anabaptist heritage, good stewardship, a building that is earth-friendly, attractive, conducive to worship, and easy to maintain. Those are a lot of different criteria, and sometimes we had to make decisions about which one we would honor at the moment, because they were sometimes in conflict with each other. But we continually sorted them out and made the best choices we could. And of course, the opinions and ideas of the individuals on the committee were sometimes in disagreement. But I was impressed and humbled at how well we worked together to talk out our disagreements and come to conclusions that we all felt were good. Consensus at work. We have been blessed throughout the project to have so many gifted people within our congregation who have given their time and expertise to create this space. It has been an interesting 5 years for me. I learned a lot. I had the privilege of working with wonderful, interesting people. Dana has been a real blessing to us, not only for his knowledge of construction, but for his knowledge of our congregation. And this project has truly been a work of the congregation. Over and over, you were asked to help with something or other, and you said yes. Also, many of you have spoken out when you were concerned about decisions that had been made or that decisions that needed to be made. I've also received a lot of positive feedback about all the work that has gone into this project. I have felt supported by the leadership group and by all of you. Have I been weary at times? Yeah. Have I questioned whether I was doing a good enough job for you? Yes, many times. Am I glad we're coming to the end? Yes. But am I glad that I did it? Yes, and yes. I know that we have not all been of one mind about whether we needed this new building. We are grateful to those of you who have supported the process, even while having questions. We know it is important that we continue to seek out ways for our building to be used throughout the week. This building is not just for us. While we own it and are responsible for taking care of it, it is truly another one of God's bountiful gifts we can use to serve God and to serve our broader community. So today it is with great joy that I am turning in my milk and honey campaign hard hat and say thank you, and the rest is up to you.
Occasions like this always invite a looking back and a looking forward. This is the approach in the biblical material, where each significant transition is a moment for teaching. How did we get here? Who was God for us back then? To what is God calling us now? What do we want to leave behind? What shall we carry with us into the future? And my favorite, what do these stones mean? I want to begin by looking back through a particular lens, one which Dag Hammarskjöld offers us. For all that has been, thanks. These words appeared on a lovely rice paper scroll back in 1992 when we finished the second major building renovation. Mary Martha Metzler, Edgar and Ethel's daughter, was the original artist, and she consented to create a second edition more recently. Some of you puzzled over these words, some chafed at them, wanted to argue with them, some of you hardly noticed them. Few of you, I suspect, are well acquainted with the author, Dag Hammarskjöld. Recently, I read a spiritual biography of Dag Hammarskjöld. He was a 20th century Swedish civil servant and diplomat who was eventually nominated to serve as the second Secretary General of the United Nations. He was, among other things, a passionate supporter of the UN, not because it brought the superpowers together, but because it gave the smaller nations a place at the table, a voice in global affairs. He died tragically in 1962 when his plane crashed en route to what was then Rhodesia under suspicious circumstances. Taking a hands-on approach, he was working at negotiating a truce between warring parties in the Congo. It seems that role still costs lives. There are many different perspectives on whether Hammarskjöld was a visionary or a failure in his work at the UN, but he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize posthumously for his work. However, what I found fascinating was his little-known spiritual life, revealed only after he died in the publication of his journals under the English title Markings. A better translation would be waymarks, a term dear to my heart as a long-distance walker. The quote that we've been referencing comes from these published journals. Hammarskjöld, coming out of what was already a post-Christian Swedish culture, was in fact a Christian mystic and one who wrestled deeply with God's call in his life and what it meant to follow after the way of Jesus. Now, while reflection on an individual life is worthwhile work as we grow into Christ-likeness, that's not what I'm doing this morning. Rather, as in the 2 Chronicles 7 text, we are here as a faith community at the dedication of a building. Not a temple, not a synagogue, not a sanctuary, but a building, a meeting house where this modest part of the body of Christ gathers to meet God and each other. Anabaptist Christians have always been reluctant to name holy places and holy times. Instead, we are to be holy people. And yet, we need some places and some times that are holy to remind us that all times and all places are holy. So, as an Assembly Faith community, when we look back at all that there has been, there is much to give thanks for. We give thanks for the willingness to try something new back in the 70s. We give thanks for John Miller, who in the mid-70s offered the metaphor of the hand. Small groups, all gathered into one larger body. We give thanks for gifted leaders, women and men, right from the beginning. It might be tempting to do a historical run-through, but we already have a very fine assembly history, which I hope all of you will sometime read. I think that there is a deeper layer of work to be done in our saying, for all that has been, thanks. I want to suggest two things that come to my mind immediately. First, I give thanks for the years that we were under discipline from Indiana-Michigan Conference. There are a number of layers to that painful time, and I'll suggest only a few. In those days, assembly was not known for its spirit of humility. There was some sense that we carried our currencies of education, intellect, creativity, connection with the church-wide agencies and institutions with some arrogance. And frankly, who needed pastors? We were overflowing with gifts of all kinds, plenty of people who could preach and generate forward-looking notions of mission, peace, and justice. At least from my point of view, the years of having our vote taken from us as we chose to welcome LGBT people into membership took us down a couple notches. It was hard going to conference gatherings in those years. I would make a point of having a retreat day before our annual sessions so that I could participate with an open spirit rather than being judgy, self-righteous, or worse yet, apologetic for the ways in which we were troublemakers. I give thanks for the LGBT people who were able to hang in with us in a variety of ways through that painful time. Yes, there were seasons of anger and disappointment, vulnerability and mistrust. But we as a congregation have been blessed immensely by the wide range of LGBT people among us. I give thanks for the slow and steady light that burned ever more brightly as more and more of us came to understand the amazing diversity of the body of Christ. Rather than diminishing our commitments, I believe that the discipline was part of clarifying a significant part of who we are to be. At the same time, I give thanks that we chose to remain in Indiana-Michigan Conference during and for a number of years after the lifting of the discipline. There are good people there, and I hope we left with both greater humility and greater appreciation for that conference, even as we have deepened our connection with Central District. Second, without question, one of the significant experiences in this congregation has been the life and ministry, the illness and death of Heidi Siemens Rhodes. How shall we give thanks for this, for all this? This little clipping was on the bulletin board in the church office for a good long spell, the old church office. If I'm not mistaken, it was Heidi who put it there. She printed up one of Richard Rohr's daily meditations entitled Gratitude. This reflection explores the relationship between love and gratitude. How do we learn to love? Rohr writes in answer to that question, "All that is needed is surrender and gratitude. Our job is simply to thank God for being part of it all and allow it to happen. The many burdens we carry are not just ours. We are in this together. The sin that comes up in us is not just our personal sin. It's the sin of the world. The joy that comes up in us is not just our personal joy. It's the joy of all creation. We are in this together as the living body of God. Love and suffering are the main portals that open up the mind space and the heart space, breaking us into breadth and depth and communion. As I witness the congregation's struggle through the shock and disbelief, the pain and the hope, the fear, and then the acceptance of Heidi's mortality, our corporate mind and heart space opened up, breaking us into a deeper communion than we had known before. Do I wish it could have been another way? Of course. And yet, I give thanks for all that has been. I know there were myriad losses, a sense of being exhausted corporately, of our remaining pastors struggling to keep their heads and hearts above water, of uncertainty of how to proceed
as we slowly exchanged roles with Heidi, caring for her and her family as she was less and less able to care for us. Expressing deep gratitude does not negate the hardship, the injustice, the pain. Yet with both of these experiences and many more in our congregational life as well as our personal lives, I believe that the work of opening ourselves to gratitude is essential if we're to move forward with the yes of what will be. The best metaphor I know for this spiritual work is that of composting. Every person, every congregation, has garbage of one kind or another, seasons of life they would rather forget. We can deny the rotten stuff in the back of the fridge or hidden away deep in the trash can, but it will soon start stinking up the whole house, attracting fruit flies and worse. Compost takes the things we want to throw out, get rid of, be done with, the rotten, decomposing stuff. Then we add heat, air, and time. Time. We turn the pile again and again and again. With grace and patience, the result is a black gold that makes for new growth, life, and vigor. As we begin laying out the garden or planting a tree, we shovel in the compost saying, thanks for all that has been, and yes to all that shall be. Love of my life, I am not dying, I am dancing.
Well, Dana, I have one more question for you. When Solomon built the temple, he built it as a place for God to live in, for God to dwell. But he also said God is bigger than one building. Even the heavens cannot contain God. It was too big. But it still sort of was a house for God to live in. And a worship space is kind of a house for God to live in. So I wanted to say, ask you, you've built a lot of houses for people to live in. Is there anything different about building a house for God to live in, or a church building, that is different than building a house?
This was the hardest question because it's certainly bigger. But when I reflected on this house and our houses, they're more similar than they are different in what they do for us and how we use them. I mean, we eat together, so we have a kitchen. And we have chairs and tables to sit at. We have bathrooms because we need bathrooms for ourselves. We have doors and windows to let light in and to for us to get in and to welcome people in. This is a bigger space. But even some places that I've built, there are special places that people set aside for meditation, prayer, and all those kind of things. I'm sitting there,
It's not that different.
There's a bit of difference in size, but other than that, our houses, I hope, reflect what this space does.
Well, thank you, Dana, for answering these questions so well. And also thank you for all the work that you did on this building so that we can be together and tell stories about God and encourage each other. And I would say any one of you who want to give Dana a high five to say thank you before you go back to your seat, stop by, give him a high five, and say thank you for all the work that he did to make this a beautiful building. No, a real high five. A real high five. Augie's right at it. Yes.
For all that will be, yes. This is the hope portion of the gratitude and hope quote we've been referencing from Dag Hammarskjöld. Its life-affirming posture mirrors the life-affirming assurances of God in the Bible. In the book of Isaiah, God says, "Fear not, For in all that will be, I am with you. I will strengthen you and help you. It's not hard to hear Israel responding to that hopeful assurance with a resounding yes. But the wisdom of Proverbs helps us distinguish God's assurance from simple optimism that everything will be great. It warns that when God's people lose their vision, there are, as one might say, negative consequences. You know, things like exile, maybe some pestilence. So at this threshold on which we stand when we dedicate our new meeting house, it is right to be asking, what is the vision we carry into the future? Who do we want to be in this new space? Now, clearly these questions are not disconnected from our past. One cannot say who we will be without noting who we have been and what has been important to us. My brief summary of who Assembly has been divides the past into three waves. The first wave of the Assembly, as I like to imagine it, was when the air was crackling with creative tension, with the desire to rediscover and live out the ways of the early church. Small groups formed, a near heretical idea at the time. Assembly members engaged in earnest Bible study. They canvassed the city to find out the needs of their neighbors, and they drafted numerous documents articulating how to be a faithful community. The movement attracted young people, men and women, who, filled with small group excitement, would eagerly declare to each other, "I want to do discernment with you." And so they did, for hours, in a way that would exhaust most others their age. These were thrilling times because the assemblyites of this first wave were not simply attending church, they were being the church. And you don't get much more Anabaptist than that. If this first wave was lodged in headspace, to use Enneagram language, the second wave moved into gut space. This started in the mid-1900s when the congregation was living into all the creative discernment of its initial 20 years. Worship became more organized. Peace and justice activism flourished. Our journey toward LGBTQ inclusion started to gain momentum. And we tasted conference discipline, finding it both sobering and something we could survive. One leader from the first wave said this second wave was when Assembly matured. We entered the third wave, according to my analysis, sometime around 2010, give or take. It's a time marked by attention getting growth, pregnancies, adoptions, rocking chairs, and a baby cave. It's also a time marked by significant death and tragedy, as well as the passing of the leadership baton from the first wave to those who came after. We had entered heart space, where a great deal of energy went into nurturing and caring for each other. The path ahead for Assembly would do well to include aspects of these three strands of the past. And what might that look like? First, I think it means offering a clear articulation of our progressive and counter-empire understanding of the gospel. We've taken a big risk pouring so much time and resources into a church building at a time when, shall we say, the Christian brand is losing significant market share. Young people particularly are rejecting the church, in part because of its ties to regressive politics, scandal, and its inability to say anything meaningful about the most important questions before us. Additionally, many of us hesitate to self-identify as Christian to people we don't know well without adding a lengthy explanation of how we're not like what you think we are. It seems to me that for a faith community to remain viable in these post-Christian times, it needs to find ways to recover, reclaim, and re-enliven the tenets of our faith in ways we find compelling. In other words, to find language to say who we are and not just who we are not. That's part of what I try to do every time I preach. Second, while articulating our faith is one needed part of our path ahead, putting it into action is how our values gain integrity. Of course, action-oriented congregations sometimes get accused of being political, but I've never been particularly concerned about that accusation as long as we understand politics not in terms of sanctifying any political party, but as instilling justice, peace, and compassion into public life. In this sense, assembly can't be a people of God's peace with religious convictions alone. It also takes complementary political convictions. And a Jesus-centered faith community worth its salt these days is one that finds active ways to advocate for the least powerful and the most scapegoated. It's one that bears witness against a society organized to protect guns rather than children. And it's one that resists the profit-driven war fossil fuel corporations are waging against the planet. Third, a church that can articulate an alternative orthodoxy and live into a shalom-based orthopraxy must also nurture a spirituality, an inner life, which lends depth to our words and deeds. This is why the assembly of tomorrow needs to be one which beckons us toward the God who interacts with our deepest self, the God who leads us to growth and transformation, the God who shapes, who helps us know the life-altering, soul-shaping truth in the claim that you are a beloved child of God. So there you have it, a vision of who we can be that looks forward but is rooted in who we've been. In fact, if you look at one of assembly's least utilized documents of the past decade, the assembly practices, you will find some echoes of this vision there. And for the curious, it's on the blue sheet in the back of your hymnals behind the covenant. Therefore, as inhabitants of this new space, let us say yes, not only to our future-giving, future-hoping God who constantly makes a way out of no way, but let us also say yes to living a life of deep fidelity, faithful to self, faithful to neighbor, faithful to God. Amen.